So I wanted to, you know, get more involved with the writing community in New York outside of just comedy.
It's like a really perfect screenplay. It's like,
Hollywood
have budget. Let a real comedy writer have a pass at the comedy.
Action, coming of age genre, Ben, sometimes from the 80s, sometimes referred to as the go for it genre.
The thing that we want to talk about is the craft.
Took out all the stakes for me, and nobody really dies at a low point. In a thriller, somebody's supposed to.
It was a lot more earned than it was in this.
The Soderbergh question. Process. What's more interesting? Thriller stakes or the actual process of things
I
being
I wish there were more films like this in the theater.
What we do know is that the aircraft touched down.
Yeah, are these the roots?
What is it?
Statue of Liberty or snowman?
Blackout and declared martial law.
Daddy, what's martial law?
Blocks back, in the intermittent shadows of mid-rises, hundreds of low forms swarm, and now is the very first time we see the forms for more than a second. Zombies. No better description. Some damaged, limbs hanging, gone, but every one of their faces placid seeming, entirely focused. Their ranks know no discrimination either. Women, men, elderly, child, black, white, obese, starving, rich, poor. In the relative open of the boulevard, we see that the zombies move like flocks of birds rather than groups of people. Almost synchronized, nobody leading, but everybody leading. Again, the feeling that Mother Nature is still at work. Flock flows over and into traffic-hemmed vehicles. People clambering out are jumped, bitten, turned.
All right, this is The Script, the official podcast of NYC Screenwriters Collective. We got a great lineup tonight. We're doing Z. We're doing World War Z. I'm here. This is David Negrin. I'm here with script doctor Jeremy Engdahl Johnson.
Hello, David.
And he's our official zombologist. You may have heard him earlier podcast on the Walking Dead, giving us his zombie science. Tonight we're reviewing the screenplay, the late 2010 draft by Michael Carnahan, who's known for The Kingdom, Lions for Lambs, and State of Play. World War Z is based on the novel by
Max Brooks. It's a book that they sold it to Brad Pitt's production group in like 2006.
I heard he's Mel Brooks' son.
He is Mel Brooks' son.
That's hilarious.
And that may be why they took the screenwriting duties out of his hands for this part.
All right. Well, the first draft of this script was by Michael Straczynski. He was the showrunner for Babylon 5 and Jeremiah, another like apocalyptic TV show that I liked, didn't last too long. He did a 2007 draft. That's how long they were working on that. Jeremy's read that draft as well. But we're going to focus tonight on the Carnahan draft because that's mostly what we're going to see this weekend. For all of you who go to see this movie this weekend, it's going to be a lot like the Carnahan draft. How is World War Z, this script for World War Z, different from all the other zombie movies and shows and comic books that we've seen before?
I think, put simply, this is the biggest zombie production in the history of zombies. There has never been more money spent on any kind of zombie production than this movie. You read the script and it's just oozing budget. It's clear that they had
dark black budget.
They had 1,500 people on set at one point. For this movie. I mean, they had 700 extras at one point.
So they're doing this with bodies. They're not just CGing the whole thing.
Well, you got to have real people fighting the CGI zombies. And it's apocalyptic in nature. Flocking theory, like all kinds of crazy things about just, these zombies moving.
But it's a 2-hour movie. So how do you classify it? Is this a disaster movie? Is this outbreak kind of a movie, where or is it you know, dude with a problem kind of movie?
Well, it's an interesting question, and we're going to get more to talking about kind of how this story has evolved from the Max Brooks original concept to where they landed with the script, because the Max Brooks concept is very distributed. It's a global epic of, you know, series of oral histories, whereas this is one man's tale. And I think they learn from some of the really bad Michael Bay movies, learn from, you know, Independence Day and you know, atrocious scripts like Deep Impact.
I like Independence Day. I thought it was fine.
Yeah, but there's too many characters, right? Too many storylines.
Yeah.
This is focused in tightly on Brad Pitt and Brad Pitt's family, which is really a far way that they've come from where it started with, you know, the Max Brooks novel, where you didn't even have a central character. You had a series of, you know, 20 to 30.
Explain that. In the novel, it's a voiceless or a personless sort of diary of what happened over the course of this world war.
Yeah, it's an investigator who's gone out to kind of collect the story, the official story of what really happened, and he's interviewing various key people from all over the world. And it's those key people at any given episode that are the central voice.
Okay, so it's very episodic. So there's different protagonists in each chapter, kind of a thing, like
exactly.
A Bret Easton Ellis novel or something like that.
Exactly.
So, but in this, we have a hero. He's got some goals. He's going out to try to save the world while, you know, shit's going down all around him.
Exactly.
Okay, great. Zombie rules. Okay. What are the zombie rules established in World War Z as opposed to Walking Dead, as opposed to, you know, every other zombie iteration? Okay.
I think, you know, what I said before about this being the biggest zombie movie, biggest zombie project ever, that in some senses sums up the zombie rules. You've got tons and tons of zombies. It's like thousands of zombies running down the street at
okay.
any given time.
But how do you kill a zombie on this?
Well,
world?
Some standard zombie rules, you know, headshot. Decapitation, you know, you gotta get the brain out of the mix, and then you can take care of it. There's some interesting moments, you know, like some of the people who are fighting the zombies, they kind of concede that they're not going to necessarily get their headshots in all the time. So there's even a little catchy saying, what is it? It's spines are divine, but knees work just fine.
All right.
So faced with these hordes of zombies coming at them in mass. Sometimes people are relegated to just disabling, even though that
yeah.
doesn't kill the zombie.
I can't help just thinking about Walking Dead so much every time, you know, when I was reading this script. And it occurred to me, I said, wow, you know, the Walking Dead people, they never, like, resorted to the knee thing. That would work really well in the Walking Dead world. Just, like, shoot people in the knees. But again, then again, one of the big differences of this zombie movie is that the antagonism, the zombies, are the mass is so much more.
Yeah.
They are thousands of zombies. It's not just, you know, a little troop of 20 or 50 here and there, and they are fast moving, right? That's one of the
very
new
fast
rules.
Moving.
Fast moving zombies here.
Yeah, these are fast moving, and it's interesting, they're quiet. They move silently, and you noted in that excerpt that I read that they were placid faced. These are dispassionate, quick moving zombies, which we learn at some point the speed at which they move may have something to do with the weather.
Interesting. Okay, that gets to let's before we figure that. That's sort of part of the ending. I agree with the silences thing. I really like how Carnahan spends time on to mention all the silences. He said, you know, yes, this is a war. You know, it's the Battle of Philadelphia, right? But one of these armies is not a conventional army. The zombies don't moan. They're quiet, right? There's a moment when the 747 crashes into the Delaware River and there's a big explosion, blah, blah, blah. And then Carnahan writes, 4 silent seconds pass as black smoke pours from 50 points across the horizon. Like, he keeps taking those moments and saying, this is not a real war where there's going to be bombs all the time. No, there's going to be a lot of quiet. Even when the mass is coming at you, you're not going to hear it.
Right, and I think the silence is an interesting one. Just a caveat up front, when I talk about the book, this is not one of those things where we complain about how it's different from the book. Brooks gave us a broad tapestry to work with, and the different screenwriters have tried to kind of portal into that tapestry. This
right.
isn't like
Straczynski's draft. He tried to keep the episodic thing, right?
Right. But what I was going to say about the silence is Brooks, he clarifies that these zombies make a lot of noise. And there's one of the great chapters in the book, which is not going to see its way onto the screen at any point, but there's a blind monk who's living in the mountains in Japan, and he can hear
nice.
The zombies coming from like a mile away. And so he hears them coming, and he prepares for them to come. And then when they show up, he kills them, and then he patiently buries them. Blind man. So, but this is a different world than what we got going with Carnahan. Carnahan, I think, saw the dramatic and the eerie potential of a bunch of silent, hoarding zombies, you know, kind of tearing towards you.
Okay, so what's the best part of his execution of this concept? Is it the prose? Is it, just the keeping us moving? I mean, because I really enjoyed some of his prose.
Yeah, he's a fabulous writer. And you know, this isn't cribbed from somewhere else. This thing is an original piece of work, and it really moves.
It doesn't read like a regular screenplay. There's a lot of text. Describing the action and describing the deaths, but also describing the human interactions. I got to tell you, one of my favorite parts of this screenplay is all the human elements, all the really human, the moments of human kindness that are a convention throughout this movie, right? Walking Dead, you know, you're jaded on Walking Dead because the whole show is about people screwing each other over worse than the zombies.
Right.
Not for this. World War Z, there's a recurring moments of human kindness throughout the script, right? Where, you know, because the zombies provide such an overwhelming antagonism. You don't need a bunch of humans saying, "Oh, you can't stay here," or "I came to steal your supplies," or you know, "I want to take what you have." Like the moment in when they hang out with the Latino family. The Latino
right.
family decides to have them for dinner, right? And they share their food. And I mean, I was just like, I was like really moved by it. And I think these moments happen throughout the script. These moments of, oh my God, chaos, end of the world, we could have just died, and then back to a human moment of kindness. And that was all, it's all described.
Right.
Walking Dead, you know, they would have had somebody say it out loud. Would have had it been on the nose. Carnahan knows better just to show these moments visually.
And you know, I, like any good script doctor, I did my Blake Snyder on this.
Good
and,
for you.
And, you know, was looking at forces of antagonism. I mean, it's clearly the zombies.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need, you know, and I mean, I'm a big fan of The Walking Dead. I like what it pulls out about human nature. And I mean, I like the kind of human-on-human battles that become the center, kind of the antagonistic focus of this whole thing. But there's something different going here. He doesn't need that. He's got such an overwhelming force of antagonism just with the zombies that, you know, he's kind of kept it a little cleaner.
While we're on the Blake Snyder, while we're on the structure, let's talk about structure for a second. Is the A story clear enough for you?
Well,
what is Jerry trying to do? What's his goal? And is his break into two when he decides to go on this mission? Is it clear why, and does he earn it? Did you buy it? Because I had trouble with it.
Well, I would say it doesn't map that well to Blake Snyder.
I don't want to hear that.
Yeah. Well, we've got a little bit of a shifting A story, and you know, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but
we're spoiling everything.
All right, why not? So
this is for people after who've seen the movie this weekend and loved it.
All right. So the third act, you know, basically got completely rewritten after it was originally shot.
Carnahan's third act has been reshot.
Yeah, it's been.
And so we won't see this ending in the movie this weekend.
Right. So we won't see how egregious they are in violating structural principles, because when the movie starts, Jerry is a family man. That's what it's all about. It's this tight subjective story about him saving his family, and that's what the whole first act is about.
Mm-hmm.
The second act, he sees essentially an opportunity to save his family by saving the world.
And he goes on a series of trips trying to do what? He's not trying. I wrote this down. I was like, what's he trying to do? Is he trying to find patient zero? Is he trying to find a cure? Is he trying to find an oasis, a safe place? Or is he just trying to save the world in general? Because it jumps from all of those things.
Well, sadly, the break into two is where the A story starts to get a little bit spastic. He's got a virologist with him when he leaves. In the second act, and the virologist is supposedly going to find a cure. Well, The role just lasts about 5 minutes before shooting himself.
I think he shoots himself in the head.
Yeah, he's and then it's like, okay, so we got this Family Guy running around in Korea and then Israel and then Russia. And he goes from, seemingly being on a mission that has some purpose. We're going to find, the virulent kind of beginning of this whole thing. And then that's not happening. And then he's just like, he's helping out the Battle of Jerusalem. And then he's leading some sort of strange, slave rebellion in Russia.
Right. He becomes like this, like, military leader. This is one of the troubles I had. Is he doesn't really have any special qualifications. He starts out, and it's a recurring joke, that he's like a low-level UN diplomat.
Right.
And he's been to war-torn countries, maybe like genocide Rwanda and other war-torn regions. Like, that's all his qualifications. He's not a scientist. He's not military. He's just Brad Pitt, He's just like, all right, I'm going to go figure these things out.
Quote-unquote normal father.
And after the first 30 pages where his kids and his wife are almost, like, torn up several different times, within about two to three pages, he's like, hey, by the way, guys, I'm going to leave.
But he's an Ebola survivor. That was a nice little, kind of tidbit. It's like a
survivor, he was just like there, like putting band-aids on people.
Well, he was there doing something. There was an Ebola outbreak, and he saved a bunch of people's lives. So
he's a hero. Okay, yeah, he has some. He's a UN. He's an aid worker. He's like, I don't know. He just didn't have a lot of skills. And then he goes from just being a father saving his family in the first act. To in the second act, sort of a Jack Ryan in Hunt for Red October, something's going down here. I need to figure it out. So I'm going to go to these places. His first place he goes is Korea, and he finds out there that they don't know anything about anything except that it may have started there because some of the first sightings were there. But then we find out later it may have been just because of the cold, right?
Right.
And then he goes to Israel, where Israel is – that's actually some of the best stuff, right?
Yeah.
Israel's pretty cool, right?
That's probably the biggest set piece that we've got going.
Yeah.
Because they've – there's a big wall, and the wall's been made bigger to prevent zombies. And the zombies are coming like a herd of zombies like you've never seen anywhere.
And they're able to figure out how to get over the wall, which is amazing.
Somehow,
this is one of the things that this script does do well. Like, I wanted to out front ask Jeremy, our zombologist, what are the rules? How do you kill the zombies? How do you beat the zombies? This movie, this draft, Carnahan's draft, really sprinkles out the rules over the course of the 2 hours. The one thing we could, the one through line that Jerry, our Brad Pitt character has, is he's figuring things out about these guys. He starts figuring out that you have to, like, kill the, shoot the spine or shoot the knees.
Right.
He starts to figure out that they're attracted to sound, loud sounds, right? And then eventually he figures out in the third act the big thing that's going to help them win, which is what?
It's the weather, and that may seem like kind of a cop out. Although this is ripped from the pages of Max Brooks, the weather serves an important role because when it gets cold, the zombies don't move as fast. And we know, anyone who's read the book knows, that was a major part of it. Winter came, and a bunch of zombies like froze up in the Canadian Rockies and so on. And the people that survive tend to be at higher altitudes where they kind of got they can use the weather as something.
Right. And so in North Korea, the zombies are a little slower. In Russia, they're a little slower. But in Israel, they're faster.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
Very interesting stuff. Okay. You want to talk – did you have a section you wanted to talk a little bit about the book versus the first draft versus the second draft?
So, the whole thing with the book – and it's interesting because when Brad Pitt acquired this, apparently he was really intrigued by the whole social commentary. And it's a very sharp social commentary that Max Brooks has created. He has this construct where you can go in and out of different countries and kind of get a sense of what happened through one interview with a person.
What do you mean? Because there's a great scene where the Israelis are bringing Palestinians into Jerusalem to save them because you know, more humans is less zombies, that thing?
That's kind of a shallow version of it. So, for example, this is something that got totally extricated from the story. We find out later for marketing reasons, but like...
The Carnahan script.
Carnahan script. But in the Max Brooks book, and this was carried over in the Straczynski script, the whole story begins with Patient Zero. And Patient Zero is in China. And what happens is that a little boy and his father are swimming in the reservoir that's created behind the Three Gorges Dam. And they're going down and they're diving for artifacts. And the father disappears and the little boy gets bitten. And that little boy...
By what?
We don't know. He gets bitten by something. So it's this whole thing of like overpopulation and environmental kind of disregard.
Okay, because China has very bad pollution and they have overpopulation.
And they built this monstrous dam, which is one of the biggest like environmental like catastrophes in the history of the world.
Okay, but we will not see that in the movie this weekend.
We will not see that at all. And the way it gets outside of China... is because there is an organ smuggling operation.
Oh, man.
And a heart gets shipped to Germany.
Because that goes on in China all the time.
Yeah, well, apparently. So it's all this kind of like...
A little bit racist.
Pointed, well, yeah, probably. Yeah. But, you know, very pointed, like, I'm going to say... You know, Brooks was going to say some things about the state of the world.
Okay.
Well, none of that finds its way. We found out later, actually, that all the China stuff got extricated because they needed this movie to sell well in China.
Yeah.
So they can't say anything bad about
it. It's a huge market.
It's a huge market. It's
huge
number
market.
Two market. So, you know. So we got nothing about China, you know.
I wanted to say, as far as social commentary and Brad Pitt, did they throw the Tommy, the Latino boy, in? They essentially adopt him.
Right.
And, you know, Brad Pitt, he can't help but, like, adopt lots of little children wherever he sees them.
Right.
Did he throw that into the script, maybe? Did you see is that possible?
I can't speak to that. I don't know if I want to be inside Brad Pitt's brain, but if I was, maybe I could tell.
Oh.
But I think that what we ended up with the Carnahan script was a much, much lighter social critique. And you've got little jokes here and there. I mean, you've got, like... you know, the joke when Newark is getting overrun and they say, well, you know, it's about as dangerous as it used to be.
right. Or no, wasn't there a good sign about like, we need to get tanks in Manhattan, right?
Right.
And they're like, they won't allow the tanks in Manhattan. They're afraid they'll rip off the streets. He's like, right, but we got to get the artillery to shoot Jersey. And all of a sudden the artillery explodes in Jersey and they're like, yeah, they had no problem with that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so it's little cute things here and there, these kind of little ironic asides, you know, humor and social commentary through dialogue instead of through these grand sweeping kind of chapters where we, you know, I think Brooks, you know, a lot of people, they comment that he really created this kind of social commentary masterpiece. I don't know. We're just going at it from a much, much subtler way.
Let's talk about the third act, which had to be reshot. In this script, what happens for our ending?
So Brad Pitt / Jerry turns into some sort of revolutionary leader. They develop a weapon called the lobotomizer, which is actually from the book. And it's basically what it sounds like. It's a weapon for dismembering and you know,
like
stabbing zombies
like
in the
chainsaw
brain.
Chainsaw or something.
It's not motorized. It's just a special kind of blade.
Oh, really?
And, yeah. And
wow.
So, because these are all a bunch of, you know, a bunch of Russian slaves who've been underground.
Right. And he sort of, he ends up in Russia. This is like the third country he's been to.
Right.
While his kids, they're no longer safe on an aircraft carrier. They've been put in, and his kids and his wife have been put in an internment camp.
Right.
Right?
You know,
okay.
In the Everglades of all places.
Yeah. And so then he leads the Battle of Russia. And do they win?
Yeah, but he wins and then it's kind of like, you know, he gets in touch with his family and you know, he's like, well, we're a long ways away and I got to get my way home and I'm going to, you know, travel all the way across the continent.
And, right. And so, and we get a few flashes of he gets to the Everglades and he's about to storm. We end with him storming the coast
of Oregon. Yeah.
Right. And there's zombies on the coast and he's got a bunch of Russian guys and he's like, let's take this beach. So essentially the victory is the previous battles, the Battle of Philadelphia, the Battle of Jerusalem were all failed. Like the zombies won all those, but then he wins the Battle of Russia or Moscow.
The Battle of Red Square, I think.
Red Square.
In the script.
And so that's supposed to be our finale. That's not enough for me.
No.
That is nowhere near enough for me. The third act of this falls flat. The stakes are the same as they are in the middle.
Well, what did it start out with? Why did we care about him at the beginning? At the beginning, he's a father defending his wife and children in a grocery store from looters. And at the end, he's, what, a revolutionary leader with a bunch of people who don't care about?
And he says he believes in God at one point.
Yeah,
that just went off. He was like an atheist, now he believes in God. That was just like, Carnahan got drunk. Or That was a producer note. I'm giving Carnahan all the credit here. Some
there
producer put that note in. But then this movie is incomplete until he finds his family. And I know you're setting up the sequel. You can set up the sequel. But this movie is unfinished until he gets back to his family.
Right. And we don't know what they did in rewriting this third act. I think
we may see that. Do you think we may see that?
I don't know. You know, it's we'll see where this thing's going to land. But
yeah.
I know that was a frustration when people watched the first cut and they thought, this is ridiculous.
It just feels unfinished. He didn't have a goal to go out and become a revolutionary and win some battles. He had a goal to maybe figure out what happened to make the world safer for his family. But if he doesn't get back to them by the end of this movie, it feels, you know, like Kill Bill. Like halfway through, I'm like, what? Is that it? Where's the rest of this movie?
Well, in the script as drafted, you know, the last interaction with the family is a cell phone conversation with his wife, where his
mm-hmm.
wife pretty much lies to him about, you know, are the kids okay? No, they're not okay, because one of the daughters has become, and this is another thing that's kind of ripped from the pages of the Max Brooks novel, this thing called a Quisling, where it's normal people who think they're zombies and they act like zombies.
Is it like a half zombie, or is it a psychological thing?
It's a mental
thing?
Illness.
It's a mental illness.
Yes.
Just, okay, you can tell us because you've read the book.
Yes.
It ends up being, it's a mental illness? Like a PTSD?
People are deluded into thinking that they're zombies and they're behaving like zombies. And they're dangerous because they're biting people. They can't infect
right.
you. But you got somebody running around, you know, brainless
and
biting.
Which was absolutely the only interesting thing about our B story in this movie. The B story in this movie, very light, right? In this script, very light. It's the mom and the kids trying to survive on what was supposed to be like a really safe aircraft carrier.
Right.
And then the daughter gets quarantined because she's a Quisling.
Yeah.
And then Terry, Jerry's friend from the UN who saved him, who Jerry had saved from genocide in Rwanda, dies very worthlessly.
Yeah, it's just like somebody like sits on his chest and he's dead. It's
right.
Like, that was stupid.
He gets pepper sprayed and
yeah.
and then they end up, she ends up in the internment camps anyway.
Yeah.
So I thought that, I mean, you what we have to talk about here from a screenwriting perspective is how much you can set up in a movie that you know they're setting up for a trilogy. How much do you have to deliver? Okay? You know, and I go to Star Wars, okay? Star Wars had fully triumphant ending
yep.
with a bunch of subplots that are left unfinished. You know, things that you cannot leave this family story unfinished. You can't, and you did not have a fully triumphant ending, you know? Brad Pitt's goal was not to go out and win a battle. His goal was to go out and find the answer, like the patient zero,
right?
Or the cure itself. If at the end of the Battle of Russia he had discovered the cure or the patient zero to begin a cure, that would have closed it a little more, right?
Sure.
If the Battle of Red Square was to find a zombie compound where the actual answer to this riddle was solved, that would have given us more closure. You didn't give us, he didn't get back to his family, he didn't find out what caused this. This movie feels unfinished to me.
Yeah, and so, you know, we'll see what they did with it, because it apparently didn't feel unfinished just to us. It felt unfinished to everybody who sat through it and watched that initial screening.
All right, so last few things. What else do we have?
Well, you know, one of the things that Brooks commented on when he sold the script was that, and I think when he first saw it, was that he thought his fans were going to be disappointed because there's this great section in the book called The Battle of Yonkers.
Ah.
It's kind of in the book, it's the pinnacle of the whole thing. It's when mankind gets overrun. And it's this ultimate example of U.S. military hubris where they're like, we're going to make a stand at Yonkers. And it's kind of a shock and awe kind of strategy.
Yeah, yeah, we're going to blow them up.
We're
going
to blow them up. Well, that doesn't work so well with zombies because zombies have no fear. So the U.S. basically just gets their butt kicked at Yonkers. And so there's been a lot of chatter. It's like, oh, there's no Battle of Yonkers. Oh, there's no Battle of Yonkers. I would argue this whole movie is the Battle of Yonkers.
Okay.
Because each of the battles is this huge epic thing where humanity is getting overrun. It happens in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
It happens in Jerusalem outside that wall.
One of the great moments in this script, in the early on in Battle of Philadelphia, they shower Jersey with artillery, and they realize it was a mistake because now they've got body pieces raining down
right.
on survivors, and you only need, you know, pieces of a zombie to kill a human being. Okay. To sum it up, best and worst parts of this script for you?
I think the first act is marvelous. I think just, you know, he really, Carnahan really did an excellent job of pulling us into the subjective in all of this. And we just have this sense of kind of what this family's facing. I mean, their cell phones are running out of juice. Their car's been stolen. They're homeless. Like, you know, they don't have enough medication for their kids. They've got no place to go. There's looting. You know, we have the first instance of someone seeing one of their family members turned into a zombie. Tommy's dad is turned into a zombie.
And this feels like a different kind of zombie movie. It does not feel like Walking Dead. It does not feel like Dawn of the Dead. It's got its own tempo and tone.
Well, it's because we actually are getting to see what happens when the crap really hits the fan.
Yeah.
And we didn't see that in Walking Dead, and we didn't see it in 28 Days Later, because the protagonist in both stories is in a hospital bed, and he wakes up after everything has gone
right.
bad.
That's the most ambitious part of this.
Right.
This was my favorite thing about Carnahan's script. It does not allow us the classic disaster film convention of a calm before the storm. There's about 30 seconds of calm in this script
right.
before we jump into it, and we get to see what it's like the moment of the apocalypse.
Right, and we don't go macro with anything until like page 32 of the script. It's right before the break into two when we get this kind of slightly contrived PowerPoint presentation of how quickly mankind is becoming extinct. But it is subjective, it's tight, it's focused on this family.
Where will this stand in the pantheon of all zombie media?
It depends what happens with the third act, because the worst part of this was the third act. The third act was bogus. It was crap. They forgot who their character was. They forgot what the goal of the story was. They forgot what the A story was. They forgot everything. So if they fix that, it could be awesome.
Because they've got to pivot to a sequel and hopefully a trilogy. Then it could have a real place in zombie history.
I'll believe it when I see it. I'm suspending judgment until I see them nail the end. You got to nail the end for this to be up there in the top five.
Fantastic. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, David.
See you soon.
Oh, this place is so full of thousands of years of myth and tragedy, and I thought something tragic was going to happen. Still there? Still there? You never stop ogling girls.
I don't ogle girls. I make love to them with my eyes.
Oh, wow. I'm stuck with an American teenager. I feel close to you.
Yeah.
But sometimes I don't know. I feel like you're breathing helium and I'm breathing oxygen.
What makes you say that?
I wanted you to say something romantic in you,
okay? You are the mayor of Crazy Town. Do you know that? You are.
This is how people start breaking up.
Oh, my God. I assure you, that guy you vaguely remember, the sweet romantic one that you met on the train, that is me. Why am I finding myself
yes.
so attracted to this woman?
Welcome to another micro installment of the Baron's Corner. You probably have to turn the volume up on your headphones or whatever because I can't talk above this frantic sotto voce. I'm in a movie theater. I'm watching Before Midnight, starring Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke. This is the third installment of a series by Richard Linklater, started in 1995. The host told me this one involves a zombie apocalypse, but all they've been doing is talking about their relationship for like over an hour, just like the last two. Only this time, there's the threat of being devoured by the undead, I guess. Maybe I'm in the wrong theater, I don't know. There are ruins and a small dark medieval street, craggy hills, etc. It's creepy. The film keeps you guessing exactly where and when a hideous, putrefying face will appear. Ethan Hawke looks just too pretty to survive an attack by zombies, but Julie Delpy just might be able to save him if she can stand him for another minute. Evidently, he's been taking her for granted and gliding through life writing two books about their relationship and sex life for the last 20 years. Did you get that? That's right. He's written two books in 20 years. His publisher must be thrilled. But everyone knows the publishing industry is like a fetid ghoul that stalks the byways of culture, drooling and groaning, the head dead, but the body doesn't know it yet. He seems to want acceptance and understanding from a woman who claims not to love him anymore. Boy, did he take a wrong turn at Albuquerque. Their life, to hear them tell it, has been a frustrating melange of small dissatisfactions stemming largely from the responsibilities inherent in raising a family. And to now meet their doom in a picturesque little Greek town is just too tragic. They are so close to the joys of middle age here in the Middle Ages. And speaking of the Middle Ages, I just survived a nude sequence. Julie Delpy is, of course, lovely, but I couldn't enjoy it, waiting for a bat or a wolf or an evil mist to come in through their hotel window. Some of the shots are unbroken for like 10, 15 or more minutes. The tension builds as we cannot escape the couple's presence, much like they feel, I imagine. I like the Greeks back at the beginning dinner sequence, and I'm just sure the elder author is a latter-day Count Dracula and will return at any minute.
Shh!
I'm going to have to leave you now. I've been speaking into my cell phone pocket, which I had my butler sew into my smoking jacket. Good thing. I think I've been largely undetected. But the woman behind me is snapping off great strands of Twizzlers and gorging herself on a soda the size of a fire extinguisher. I'm not kidding. But it's only a matter of time till she runs out of empty calories, and then she tries to eat me. The Baron is very afraid. Until next time, look for the small frills, and I'll see you in the Baron's Corner.
Greetings, programs. Once again, this is your Tracking Board czar, Mike DeLuca, with a monthly preview of the treasures you can find at the website The Tracking Board. This is not an advert. I assure you it's five flavors of awesome, including Charlie Chocolate Factory, Sex Machine. Shout out to Willy Wonka. Let's get started with this week's spec and pitch sales. From John Quaintance and David Feeney, showrunners of the single-camera comedy of late on Fox, Ben and Kate, we've got Don't Mess with Texas. The logline, a cop and prisoner flee crooked cops while on the run in Texas. It's set up at Universal with Dana Fox and Reese Witherspoon producing, and Reese and Sofia Vergara starring. I think this has the makings of a gender-inverted midnight run. But say what you will about Sofia Vergara, she wishes she had De Niro's mall. Sexy! The writers are represented by CAA and UTA. Next up, we have a new pitch from Nick Kelman, who last August sold a mystery sci-fi project to Lorenzo de Boaventura called Emergence, and it's been acquired by Roland Emmerich's production company, Centropolis Entertainment. Surprisingly, it's a large-scale sci-fi movie, a genre of film Emmerich is not at all known for, Godzilla, Independence Day, 2012. It's also said to be grounded in real science, which explains why my Stargate refuses to work. But they say that happens to a lot of guys. Kelman is rep by CAA, and I'm rep by my homies, Westside. Lastly, from writer Jamie Dawson, we've got Young Agatha. The logline, during World War I, years before becoming a world-renowned author, young nurse Agatha Christie undertakes the investigation of a wounded soldier who was murdered while under her care. Presumably, she waxes her mustache and gathers everyone in the parlor to weigh their guilt, just like Hercule Poirot. While I try to get Jeff Goldblum to have a ride on my Orient Express. But seriously, not since Vanessa Redgrave's Oscar-winning turn in 1979's Agatha has anyone truly captured Christie in a project, so I think this has promise. The writer's managed by Plumeria Entertainment Management, and the script is set up at BCDF Pictures, which was behind 2012's Josh Radnor comedy drama Liberal Arts. Next on to this week's specs that have hit the market like Maggie Smith's pimp hand at Downton Abbey. First up, from Evan Foster, whose thriller Table 18 sold to Radioactive Giant in January, we have Bullet Run, which is pitched as Speed meets Thief. Derivative? Perhaps. But seriously, though, there are worse places to draw from, like Burt Young's nude modeling portfolio. The project is attached to Vincent Newman Entertainment, and the writer's rep by David Saunders at APA. Next up, we've got Autograph, from writer Debbie Scott, It's based on a novel by Barbara Patella called Full Moon Morning, a Shanghai Survivor's Story. The logline: a boy secretly watches his actor father run a con so the family can survive World War II Shanghai. But the father's arrested, so the boy applies what he's learned to survive. Grammatically unsound loglines aside, this project seems to have taken a page from the J.G. Ballard playbook. The question is Christian Bale's son available? Interestingly enough, the writer is represented by the Silver Batella Agency. Her agent? Barbara Batella. Conspiracy, anyone? Lastly, from Daniel Frey and Russell Summer, whose historical action spec Bleeding Kansas made the 2010 blacklist, we've got Lewis and Clark, Trial by Fire, and It Is What You Think It Is. I admit I did a double take as I briefly pondered a sad reteaming of Dean Cain and Terry Hatcher. Logline, pitched as Pirates of the Caribbean meets Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. It's a reimagining of the historic expedition. After the United States acquires the Louisiana Territory, President Thomas Jefferson sends Lewis and Clark on a journey to the American West that is believed to be inhabited by fearsome beasts that threaten the entire country. Now, that's a logline and a half, folks. But they could have just said, Almost Heroes, the action version. What, Almost Heroes? Come on. No love for Chris Farley and Matthew Perry? Tough crowd. The writers represented by Paradigm. Until next time, this is Mike DeLuca, your tracking board czar, signing off.
Girls, time for your Adderall.
You know.
My homie Mark.
Hey.
Hi, I'm Nikki. This is Sam.
Hi.
Oh my God, that's Paris Hilton. It's Kirsten Dunst. I just think we wanted to be a part of, like, the lifestyle that everybody kind of wants.
Hey, I can be the answer. I'm ready to dance when the band
bar- Paris Hilton's hosting a party in Vegas tonight.
Where does she live? Do you think we could find a way in?
I don't know.
Come on, let's go to Paris's. I want to rob.
I was in the 212 on the uptown.
Awesome.
You know what summer
doing? Oh, my God.
That's
a cute dress. Did you get a new dress?
Mm-hmm.
We had so many beautiful things.
Oh, right. But you want to.
Ladies?
He looks hot.
I hear helicopters.
We're in LA. Don't be such a little bitch. You're stressing me out.
Aaron. Hi, this is co-host Christopher Theokas. And in this segment, we're going to talk about Sofia Coppola's The Bling Ring. Joining me today is our man from Amsterdam, sound recordist Chris Durham, also a member of the NYC Screenwriters Collective, and Denise Pappas, again another member from the NYC Screenwriters Collective, and most importantly, a girl. Today we'll be discussing the screenplay The Bling Ring by Sofia Coppola, the October 6, 2011 draft. The Bling Ring is based on a true story of a group of high school students burglarizing the homes of celebrities such as Paris Hilton and Lindsay Lohan out in L.A. The burglaries took place, I guess, back in the late aughts. Does anybody know, did anybody actually read the Vanity Fair article on which this was based?
I didn't. No,
Denise?
I looked for it, and I couldn't find it online today. So.
Well, we did discuss this in one of our pro-script meetings in the NYC Screenwriters Collective, of which I moderated quite adeptly, if I do say so myself. And I have to admit, in the meeting itself, the reactions to the screenplay, this particular draft, were, if I remember correctly, pretty poor. You guys were both there.
I would say that it was lukewarm to begin with, but as we talked about it over the course of the workshop, I think... more and more people, I certainly warmed up to it, and as we started to break the script apart and kind of see what was really going on with it and what I think Sofia Coppola was trying to say, I certainly kind of warmed up to the script, and I was really looking forward to going back and reading it for this podcast.
I actually wanted to see it after we finished discussing it, because I remember a lot of the comments that we were getting, especially in the first half of the meeting, were, I would say, quite negative towards the characters. You know, I put characters in quotes because these are real people. And some of the complaints lodged by the readers of it were, you know, that there was no likable central character to follow. It was kind of questionable as to who was our intro, our character that would lead us into this world, our everyman character. Although we did, I think I'll finally agree that it was the Mark character. But ultimately, you know, there were a lot of typical, I think, complaints that you would find about a genre piece, where there wasn't an escalation of stakes, there wasn't the likable or at least sympathetic central character, there wasn't a personified antagonist or a personification of the antagonistic forces. But you're right, like the second half when we discussed it, when we opened the discussion up, I think everybody's perception of what was actually happening in the script changed.
I think the issue is that the characters weren't really built up. There wasn't a big character build up in the front, and I think after speaking about it in the second half, we realized Sofia Coppola was doing that intentionally.
Right.
Yeah. That actually kind of speaks to, I was reading a Hollywood Reporter article today about, what they say is a lackluster premiere of this movie, The Camp. And one of the things they say, and of course I haven't seen the movie, just read the script a couple of times, I disagree with this from the script, but who knows. It says, The Blue Marine completes a triptych of 2013 films, including Pain and Gain and The Spring Breakers, about incredibly stupid people doing incredibly stupid criminal things, viewed from a strikingly ambivalent, non-committal directorial perspective. Now, we haven't seen the movie, but I would certainly not argue that the tone of the script is ambivalent in any way. I think there's definitely a voice there, and there's definitely an opinion.
Yeah, I would agree, and I would disagree with them being dumb or stupid. When I was reading the script, the character struck me as bored.
Exactly.
And
yeah, and you know, I think upon my second reading, I actually see this as more of an indictment of society than of these teenagers.
Right.
Or even this McMansion culture, you know, they're talking in Calabasas or you know, wherever you are. It's more of a cultural indictment than these individuals.
Right, then, yeah.
The thing that I liked that she did is that maybe this is what they didn't like about it, is that she didn't ask for you to make them heroes or to hate them. She just showed you what they did and tried to, like, step back from it. And I didn't want to be forced to empathize, and I didn't want to be forced to love them. So that's what I liked about it.
If I remember correctly from, you know, not just the script, but the meeting or the workshop as well, was that one of the, I don't want to say indictments, but one of the things leveled at the script was that the characters were one-dimensional. And, you know, it's typical in a typical script and a typical story, especially, you know, from what we go to movies for, one-dimensionality is frowned upon. And, you know, in a lot of ways, after we discussed it, I felt like it really worked a lot better. I mean, not to say that all the characters were one-dimensional, but, you know, I think it worked in this case. And I can understand the Hollywood Reporter saying what they said about the movie because of this, but I honestly think it was intentional on Ms. Coppola's part.
Yeah, you know, I would agree. I think it's intentional, and you know, I wouldn't criticize it. I mean, you know, from your typical character arc point of view, you
right.
might criticize that. But I think in terms of what she's trying to do with the film, you know, it's not only the characters that she's showing this one-dimensionality, and she's also showing, you know, an emptiness in most of the aspects of their lives. You know, you have this character of Laurie, who is the mother, played by Leslie Mann,
right.
In the movie. You know, she's this mother of these two girls and one girl they've taken in, and is a very spiritual person. At one point, she says she's a minister. But when you see what they're doing, they're saying grace around the table and they're praying to the universe, and it's this very, like, empty, you know, kind of almost like commercial, a very surface kind of spirituality.
Spirituality without
yeah.
a backbone.
And you know, of course, you know, even later on in the script, when things are going bad for them, you know, the mother is kind of there, and the universe is doing good things for us, and this is all for a reason. But it's all very hollow. And so I think everything that, you know, from down to the accoutrements of the movie, the trappings, in these houses, she describes them in the script as
right.
McMansions, which we all associate
with bad
track housing,
yeah.
you know, mm-hmm. like just put it up. But everything in here is empty, it's flash, it's glamour, that's going to come out, I think, in her visual style when you see the movie.
Right.
One thing also I noticed is that all the characters, I mean, especially the teenagers, they're more vacuous than if you were writing, like, Clueless, like a teenage comedy. They're that flat and that one-dimensional that, I mean, this could be a comedy.
I imagine it kind of is. I mean, it's bandied about that it was a bit of a satire. It just kind of got the laughs, I think, at one point. But you know, seeing these things on the page and then seeing them on the screen, I think, is a different experience. And I'll probably keep going back to this well. But, you know, Argo, the dialogue in Argo, you know, a lot of us that read it thought, yeah, it was fine, but it wasn't anything to write home about. But then when we saw the movie, the actors brought a lot to it. And, you know, the actors are going to look at a script and they're going to make a backstory for their characters, hopefully, and bring, you know, an intention to the line. That said, you know, like, so other aspects of the scripts, if we're typically doing a heist film, which this isn't, but there are burglaries in it, and, you know, a heist film is typically about, they're typically about burglaries of some sort. In a typical heist film, the stakes are raised, and, you know, it's like they start out stealing something small, and the scale of it gets bigger. Or they start out stealing from, you know, if you have a group of thieves, they start stealing from a low security place to a high security place. And there's an attention to the scale of the burglary, the robbery, whatever. In this, the robberies or the burglaries just seem to be the same thing over and over again. And, you know, it's like if we're looking at this as a heist script, that would be a detriment to the script.
Yeah, but I disagree that the stakes don't change. But I do think it's actually important to the script that we use the same thing over and over. Because you have the character of Rebecca, right?
Right.
Who I think is actually kind of the antagonist here, in a way. But you see her and you see Mark, and they're really all about the lifestyle, right?
Right.
There's these scenes where they've broken into these houses, and everybody's going through drawers, stealing shoes, stealing bags, and Rebecca is sitting on the couch smoking a cigarette.
Right.
Because she just wants to be part of that lifestyle.
She wants to be in the room.
Yeah, and so I think that's important. I do think over time, the stakes start to get raised, though. There's a point where Rebecca steals a piece of art.
Right,
there's
yeah.
a point where Mark steals Rolexes, and, you know,
tries to sell them.
At the midpoint, he kind of sells them, thus going from, like, somebody who's glomming onto this fame to an actual crook.
Right,
think.
Yeah.
And also the Golden Fleece of Lindsay Lohan.
Oh, yeah,
who's
that's
the
true.
Last, I think that's the last house they hit, and
yeah.
also what causes the downfall.
Right.
And she's the Golden Fleece.
Well, that's the thing. When they steal the art, like, when I was reading the script, it didn't seem to be that, you know, because it was just kind of an aside, like, oh, let's just steal some art. It didn't seem like we're going to go for this piece of art. And I mean, I'm okay with that. I don't want to say that, you know, like, I think this is bad. Because, you know, there was something about the way it was written that made me think of Silence of the Lambs, oddly enough. And it was, in Silence of the Lambs, there's a difference between real world, you know, where Clarice is dealing with the FBI and regular people, and then the world of the serial killer, which is a fantasy world. So when she first meets Hannibal Lecter, she descends into a cave, you know, a den, and there's David Negrin. So oddly enough, one film that The Bling Ring made me think of was Silence of the Lambs. In that, when you have Clarice Starling in, I guess what you could call the real world, when she's dealing with the FBI, when she's dealing with the case itself, it looks like the real world. And when she deals with serial killers, if there's just one in the scene, it's almost like she's in a fantasy world. So when she meets Hannibal Lecter, you know, she goes into a cave, into a dungeon, essentially, to meet him. And then she meets Buffalo Bill, I think. Again, she descends. There's a lot of descending with these characters. And even when Buffalo Bill is on his own and he's at the door with her, you know, you see the moth in the corner, and things are a little out of order and things like that. And I felt there was something similar happening in The Bling Ring, where they were living this world. In this world, it was kind of a dreamscape when they were in these houses and so on. And then when the police finally came on the scene, reality kind of came crashing in. And I even think that there was a change in the writing at that point. Do you guys agree? Come on, Denise.
I didn't get that at all, actually. I didn't think that the lies were that different from the people that they were stealing from. Middle class.
Well, what I mean is, like, when the police came in, like, the tone of the film or the script changed in terms of, like, how it would maybe appear in your head or whatever.
Yeah, the bad guys pose in kind of thing, but I really didn't get that.
I think that there's certainly something jarring about the police scenes, the investigative scenes, the reporting scenes. Like they just kind of flowed in and flowed out all through the second half of the second half. and the third act. It does feel weird, and maybe it is because, you know, the whole rest of the world, not just the world that they're robbing, but the world that they come from, seems so
almost unattainable.
Yeah, and so guilty. It's very much so. And you know, then it's just cold interviews, watching video.
Me in the back from a cop.
Yeah.
And also before, in the beginning, they would go to the same clubs and they'd see like Misha Barton or whatever at the club. So they're looking at it through this window, and then, you know, then they're actually on Paris Hilton's stripper pole.
Right.
Which is like the views kind of turn in a sense.
Did you get the impression that Mark, that kind of the main character, was poor at, like, in like a universal sense or relative to the others? Or was he basically on the same level?
I thought he was poor relative.
Right. But he was still like rich, kind of.
He still wasn't poor.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I get, like, I feel like I'm supposed to have that impression, but if I think back to the script, actually it was something that occurred to me in this reread. There's nothing really that expressly says it. There are clues that he doesn't fit in for some reason. I chalk that up, to his inferred gayness in
right.
high school. And actually, my first reading, I was like, I'm just assuming it. As I went back through, there's actually, you know, so some more not so subtle hints about that, but I thought it came more from that than
the thing that made me think that he was a little bit poor, but not poor, is because in the first scene, you know, Rebecca approaches him at the locker when he's like a new kid,
right?
And I thought for the reason that she would do that is only because he must be wearing something cool, like a rag and bone sweater or something, because she doesn't seem like she's just going to hang out with that dirty little new kid.
Yeah,
and the fact that he must be doing something, or he's a cool stylist.
Yeah, no, that's still true. Like, when I first started reading it, you know, and by page, you know, 3 or 4, you got this kid and is getting dropped off by his mom. I just thought, you know, as much as I love teen movies, I'm sick of this trope where it's the new kid at school and it's his first day and he's going to have a hard time. And it was both refreshing and a little off-putting to see that turn on its head. It's like he's instantly accepted
right.
into, you know, like these cool kids. You know?
It is an easy way to get into a story, and that actually makes me think of ER, the TV show, because we're brought into the world of the emergency room with John Carter because it's his first day. And so he's the new kid on the block. And it's easy to get in that way. You know, we are brought into the world at the same time.
Oh, sure. It's But, you know, like, being the new kid on the block, that, you know, that's a great convention in movies. Being, you know, new kid, like, first day, that's been done. Like, it's never been done half as good as Karate Kid, so.
Yeah.
He also becomes such a major part of this ring, where he's, like, Googling where they live. He's finding out when they're gone. He's becomes, like, this major head of this whole ring anyway. So he's not just new kid to, like, okay, I'll do anything to be cool. He's like new kid to, I'm part of the top echelon.
Right, he's not a leader, but he is certainly part of the brains of it. I was reading something, I wish I could say where it was, but when you're going into a story with a traditionally unsympathetic character, that what you want to do is give them a problem everybody can relate to, a common problem. So if you look at Breaking Bad with Walter White, he has cancer. Now, God forbid we should all get cancer. But it's a problem that we can all relate to. And then the character with the common problem does something extreme. In this case, cooked meth. And in a way, I feel like The Bling Ring was missing that. That this is there was nothing explicit about it. But again, I think, you know, we said earlier that these characters struck us as bored. Did you guys want something where they said, why are we doing this? And, you know, why are we going to these places and burglarizing?
Seemed more real to me that they were just bored because, I mean, they don't have any reason to have angst.
Right.
If they're from these, like, middle class, what's their problem?
Yeah.
You know?
And they don't have parents that are coming down on them.
Right.
You know, from the type of movie this is, you know, for her wanting to make a statement, you know, a social statement, I don't feel like I do that. You know, maybe,
you don't need them to say, like, I'm bored.
Right, or I don't need that, like, yeah, let's have the everyman problem and then do something extreme.
Right.
Right?
I certainly thought this was explicit enough about their boredom. That's why I really disagree with the Hollywood Reporter assessment of it.
Yeah. No, and, you know, I relate to it. Like, when I was a kid, I was in trouble. Like, and I did stupid things.
No.
I did stupid things. Like, I was 9 or 10, and it was winter, and we went, you know these white canvases they put over greenhouses, and some friends were walking on them. We were just kind of having fun doing something stupid in the winter. Ended up costing, like, our parents thousands of dollars. You know,
because you were bored.
Because we were bored. And these kids, it's the same thing. You know, like, I said something, and it's not true. I said something when we were in a workshop. I said, these feel like victimless crimes, right? And they're not. And I was even reading a thing about, you know, Paris Hilton felt so victimized by this. You know, like, she didn't really understand or you know, hadn't internalized until she saw it on the screen, right? And then felt terribly violated.
Denise, I don't feel bad for Paris Hilton. Won't even notice that she's missing a pair of shoes.
Well, and that's the thing. That's like where I think these kids are coming from, right? They're going in, they're stealing, they saw it, they're stealing underwear, they're stealing shoes. Half this stuff probably came from gift baskets and award shows, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what you think. And, you know, but then by the end, they're ripping off Rolexes.
And guns. And cocaine.
Yeah, so you know, but like, I think at the beginning...
I
think at the beginning it's boredom. They don't really internalize the criminality of what they're doing. You know, it's just kind of let's go do something. You know, we're just going. In fact, they say, you know, we're going over to Paris' house, right? They don't say, you know, like.
Let's go rob Paris.
Nikki says, I want to rob, right? But everybody else is like, we're just going to Paris' house. We're going to Rachel Bilson's house.
Maybe that's part of the concept too. It's like we put famous people up, and when are they human? When do they stop being human at this point? They don't even, these kids don't even think that they have feelings at this point.
I kind of wonder if they've used it, like if they had in real life and in the script burgled different celebrities, because it's like the tendency is we don't particularly feel bad for Paris Hilton, but what if it had been Clive Owen? What if it had been like Susan Sarandon or, you know, Julianne Moore or somebody like that? Would we have felt bad? Like, oh, that poor person whose house got burgled, like,
someone who's famous for actually doing something.
Yeah, you know, it's like...
you know, like in a couple cases, they are. I mean, they rob Megan Fox, right? You know, you can debate her merits as an actress, but at least she's earned.
I think she's
great.
Wonderful.
I love her.
She's amazing.
You know, and they Orlando Bloom. Yeah, so...
Well, any final thoughts on The Bling Ring? Written by Sofia Coppola, directed by Sofia Coppola, out in theaters on June 14th.
I liked her. I liked the way she commented, the social commentary has on her opinion. I don't know if this was true, but the way that they got into the houses were so easy, and I kind of thought it meant like, you know, nothing's locked, they just walked in. Like, that's how easy it was for these people to get famous. And that's what these kids saw.
And there was an invulnerability to the famous people.
And,
yeah.
And that's what they were going for.
I thought, what's that? I mean, I thought it was good the first time I read it. I thought it was better the second time I read it. You know, one thing that's remarkable, and we were talking about this earlier, when we did the workshop, after the first half of the workshop, I think you asked, you know, who wants to see this movie, and like three people raised their hand. And, you know, like, after the second half of the workshop, after we had a little bit more open conversation about it, you know, all 2/3 of the workshop raised
their hand. Right, about 15, 16
you know,
people.
And so, you know, I think this is one of those things that's going to come out coming from script to screen. It, you know, it's written by a director for herself, and for that, it actually stands up as a well-written screenplay that
right.
could be taken by any director. You know, it's not written in a self-indulgent way. So I think, you know, I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm looking forward to seeing it too. If you have any comments about The Bling Ring, whether it be on the script or the movie itself, drop us a line at scriptfeed@gmail.com and subscribe to our Twitter feed at @scriptfeed.
Did you speak to any of the victims?
I've spoken to all the victims.
Really? What did Lindsay say?
The Script is the official podcast of the NYC Screenwriters Collective. It is produced and edited by Tawny Foskett. Chris Durham is our sound recordist and mixer. If you live in NYC, check out our weekly review meetings through meetup.com at NYC Screenwriters Collective. Find us on Facebook at NYC Screenwriters Collective. Follow us on Twitter @ScriptFeed and email us at scriptfeed@gmail.com.